Christmas Day, usually so happy a season, brought no alleviation of our gloom. My brother's reserve continually increased, and even his longest established habits appeared changed. He had been always most observant of his religious duties, attending divine service with the utmost regularity, whatever the weather might be, and saying that it was a duty a landed proprietor owed as much to his tenantry as himself to set a good example in such matters. Ever since our earliest years, he and I had gone morning and afternoon on Sundays to the little church of Worth, and there sat together in the Maltravers chapel, where so many of our name had sat before us. Here their monuments and achievements stood about us on every side, and it had always seemed to me that, with their name and property, we had inherited also the obligation to continue those acts of piety, in the practice of which so many of them had lived and died. It was, therefore, a source of surprise and great grief to me when, on the Sunday after his return, my brother omitted all religious observances and did not once attend the parish church. He was not present with us at breakfast, ordering coffee and a roll to be taken to his private sitting room. At the hour at which we usually set out for church, I went to his room to tell him that we were all dressed and waiting for him. I tapped at the door, but on trying to enter, found it locked. In reply to my message, he did not open the door, but merely begged us to go on to church, saying he would possibly follow us later. We went alone, and I sat anxiously in our seat with my eyes fixed on the door, hoping against hope that each late comer might be John, but he never came. Perhaps this will appear to you, Edward, a comparatively trivial circumstance, though I hope it may not, but I assure you that it brought tears to my eyes. When I sat in the Maltravers chapel and thought that for the first time my dear brother had preferred in an open way his convenience or his whim to his duty, and had of set purpose neglected to come to the house of God, I felt a bitter grief that seemed to rise up in my throat and choke me. I could not think of the meaning of the prayers nor join in the singing, and all the time that Mr. Butler, our clergyman, was preaching, a verse of a little piece of poetry which I learnt as a girl was running in my head. How easy are the paths of ill, how steep and hard the upward ways, a child can roll the stone downhill that breaks a giant's arm to raise. It seemed to me that our loved one had set his foot upon the downward slope, and that not all the efforts of those who would have given their lives to save him could now hold him back. It was even worse on Christmas Day. Ever since we had been confirmed, John and I had always taken the sacrament on that happy morning, and after service he had distributed the Maltravers dole in our chapel. There are given, as you know, on that day to each of the 12 old men 5 pounds and a green coat, and a like sum of money with a blue cloth dress to as many old women. These articles of dress are placed on the altar tomb of Sir Esmund de Maltravers, and have been thence distributed from days immemorial by the head of our house. Ever since he was 12 years old, it had been my pride to watch my handsome brother doing this deed of noble charity, and to hear the kindly words he added with each gift. Alas, alas, it was all different this Christmas. Even on this holy day, my brother did not approach either the altar or the house of God. Till then, Christmas had always seemed to me to be a day given us from above, that we might see, even while on earth, a faint glimpse of that serenity and peaceful love which will hereafter gild all days in heaven. Then covetous men lay aside their greed and enemies their rancor, then warm hearts grow warmer, and Christians feel their common brotherhood. I can scarcely imagine any man so lost or guilty as not to experience on that day some desire to turn back to the good once more, as not to recognize some far-off possibility of better things. It was thoughts free and happy such as these that had previously come into my heart in the service of Christmas Day, and been particularly associated with the familiar words that we all love so much. But that morning the harmonies were all jangled. It seemed as though some evil spirit was pouring wicked thoughts into my ear, and even while children sang, "Hark the herald angels," I thought I could hear through it all a melody which I had learned to loathe, the Gagliarda of the Areopagita. Poor Constance! Though her veil was down, I could see her tears, and knew her thoughts must be sadder even than mine. I drew her hand towards me, and held it as I would a child. After the service was over, a new trial awaited us. John had made no arrangement for the distribution of the dole. The coats and dresses were all piled ready on Sir Esmoun's tomb, and there lay the little leather pouches of money, but there was no one to give them away. Mr. Butler looked puzzled, and approaching us said he feared Sir John was ill. Had he made no provision for the distribution? Pride kept back the tears, which were rising fast, and I said my brother was indeed unwell, that it would be better for Mr. Butler to give away the dole, and that Sir John would himself visit the recipients during the week. Then we hurried away, not daring to watch the distribution of the dole, lest we should no longer be able to master our feelings, and should openly betray our agitation. From one another we no longer attempted to conceal our grief. It seemed as though we had all at once resolved to abandon the farce of pretending not to notice John's estrangement from his wife, or of explaining away his neglectful and unaccountable treatment of her. I do not think that three poor women were ever so sad on Christmas Day before as were we on our return from church that morning. None of us had seen my brother, but about 5 in the afternoon Constance went to his room, and through the locked door begged piteously to see him. After a few minutes he complied with her request and opened the door. The exact circumstances of that interview she never revealed to me, but I knew from her manner when she returned that something she had seen or heard had both grieved and frightened her. She told me only that she had flung herself in an agony of tears at his feet, and kneeling there, weary and broken-hearted, had begged him to tell her if she had done aught amiss, had prayed him to give her back his love. To all this he answered little, but her entreaties had at least such an effect as to induce him to take his dinner with us that evening. At that meal we tried to put aside our gloom, and with feigned smiles and cheerful voices, from which the tears were hardly banished, sustained a weary show of conversation, and tried to while away his evil mood. But he spoke little, and when Foster, my father's butler, put on the table the three-handled Maltravers loving cup that he had brought up Christmas by Christmas for 30 years, my brother merely passed it by without a taste. I saw by Foster's face that the master's malady was no longer a secret even from the servants. I shall not harass my own feelings nor yours, my dear Edward, by entering into further details of your father's illness, for such it was obvious his indisposition had become. It was the only consolation, and that was a sorry one, that we could use with Constance, to persuade her that John's estrangement from her was merely the result of manifestation of some physical infirmity. He obviously grew worse from week to week, and his treatment of his wife became colder and more callous. We had used all efforts to persuade him to take a change of air, to go to Royston for a month, and place himself under the care of Dr. Dobie. Mrs. Temple had even gone so far as to write privately to this physician, telling him as much of the case as was prudent, and asking his advice. Not being aware of the darker sides of my brother's ailment, Dr. Dobie replied in a less serious strain than seemed to us convenient, but recommended in any case a complete change of air and scene. It was, therefore, with no ordinary pleasure and relief that we heard my brother announce quite unexpectedly one morning in March that he had made up his mind to seek change and was going to leave almost immediately for the Continent. He took his valet Parnham with him, and quitted Worth one morning before lunch, bidding us an unceremonious adieu, though he kissed Constance with some apparent tenderness. It was the first time for 3 months, she confessed to me afterwards, that he had shown her even so ordinary a mark of affection, and her wounded heart treasured up what she hoped would prove a token of returning love. He had not proposed to take her with him, and even had he done so, we should have been reluctant to assent, as signs were not wanting that it might have been imprudent for her to undertake foreign travel at that period. For nearly a month we had no word of him. Then he wrote a short note to Constance from Naples, giving no news, and indeed scarce speaking of himself at all, but mentioning, as an address to which she might write, if she wished, the Villa de Angelis at Posillipo. Though his letter was cold and empty, yet Constance was delighted to get it, and wrote henceforth herself nearly every day, pouring out her heart to him, and retailing such news as she thought would cheer him.